got a countdown and it's time for blast off. I hear a little feedback myself. I don't know where that might be coming from. How's the volume sound to the class? I'm looking at the screen here. Let me know if you can hear me okay, because volume is weak, somebody says. Cam can hear and see. A few of them are saying it's a little weak. We have our expert Danny right behind me here, so, and Robert can hear fine. Everything ought to be in good shape, I guess. Okay here, says Leslie.
Is that any better?
How is it now? A few people said sound gone for a second. It's back. Okay, how is it? How does it sound? Okay? Okay, back again. Good. Okay. That's good. Okay. Success is ours. We can blast off after the countdown. Okay, well, thanks, Danny. And welcome back, everyone, to week two. I thought... this week, the way I put together the course is to talk, as you know, sometimes about history and sometimes economics. And so I thought I'd try to look at sort of a historical or chronological progression this week with American banksterism. And last week was more of a theoretical outline of the reasons for the existence of banksterism. So this week I thought we'd get into some of the history of the actual adoption of banksterism in the United States. And the things that happened here, I think, have happened in some way or another in a lot of other countries. England was among the first to adopt our style of central banking. In fact, the American Central Bank was modeled after the Bank of England. The early advocates of central banking in America were all advocates and worshipful advocates of the Bank of England. And so they always wanted some mechanism, some mercantilistic mechanism like the Bank of England to be opposed in the United States. And so turning to Rothbard, I thought I would start out with his really insightful comment in his book, Mystery of Banking, about what the early advocates of a central bank were all about, what they were really advocating in the United States. And so in the first national bank, or a bank run by politicians, but owned partly by private individuals, was the Bank of North America. And so what was the purpose of this bank? Well, the purpose of the bank was always tied to the economic agenda of the economic nationalists in America. And the economic agenda, as I said last week, was called the American system, which really wasn't, there was nothing American about it. It was British mercantilism, but brought over to America in those days. And here's what Rothbard said. He said the purpose, and these people were led by an American businessman named Robert Morris, who was said to be probably maybe the richest man in America at the time of the American Revolution. He was also what today we would call a defense contractor. He made a lot of money selling armaments and arranging for the purchase of armaments by the U.S. government, or by the Revolutionary Army, really. And so their purpose, though, was this, according to Rothbard, to reimpose in the new United States a system of mercantilism and big government similar to that in Great Britain, against which the colonists had rebelled. The object was to have a strong central government, particularly a strong president or king as chief executive, built up by high taxes and heavy public debt. Strong government was to impose high tariffs to subsidize domestic manufacturers, develop a big navy to open up and subsidize foreign markets for American exports, and launch a massive system of internal public works. In short, the United States was to have a British system without Great Britain. And an important part of what Rothbard called the Morris scheme was, quote, to organize and head a central bank to provide cheap credit and expanded money for himself and his allies. The Bank of North America was deliberately modeled after the Bank of England. So as soon as the American Revolution was over, there was a group of men in American politics, merchants, bankers, and politicians, who wanted to adopt the very type of economic system, economic and political system, that the American Revolution had been fought to get away from. When I make speeches about this, I usually compare this to Mel Brooks, the actor Mel Brooks, in the movie A History of the World Part 2, where Mel Brooks plays the King of France. And he keeps saying, as a laugh line all through the movie, it's good to be the king, it's good to be the king. And that's sort of the attitude that Alexander Hamilton and the early nationalists had, that if you're on the paying end of a corrupt mercantilist system, that's not a good thing. But if you're on the collecting end, it's a good thing. It's good to be the king, collecting all the booty from this system. And so that's what they were up to. And the Bank of North America was established, and it was given a monopoly, a government enforced monopoly of currency issue, but it so inflated its currency that within 1 year, no one had any confidence in it and had to be privatized. But they never give up. Still to this day, they don't give up to this day. And speaking of this day, by the way, I'm not used to making predictions, but and very few Austrians are making really specific predictions, but I just learned yesterday that it's a no-brainer to predict that there's going to be a stock market crash, or at least the bursting of a bubble in the American stock market. And the evidence of that is that in the front page of quite a few papers yesterday was a picture of Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, claiming that there is no bubble in the stock market. And you can go online and Google Bernanke and real estate bubble and find him saying in 2005, 2006, 2007, there is no bubble in real estate. And so I think that's proof positive that there is a bubble. But getting back to the history part, they never gave up. And so Robert Morris, this wealthy man, one of the wealthiest men in America, recruited a young disciple, Alexander Hamilton, even before Hamilton was out of the war, even before the war was over, these two got together. And so and Hamilton was a bright guy, but he knew nothing about finance and money. And so he wrote a famous letter to the richest man in America. He was an assistant to the most powerful man in America, George Washington, during the Revolution. And so now that he's going to be out of work and the Revolution was over, he wrote a long letter, a 30-page letter, to the richest man in America, which was essentially a job application. And the job application was pretty much a letter saying, I agree with you with this American system. I mean, it's all a great idea. The quotation I just read to you from Rothbard about what they wanted to do to reimpose in the new United States a system of mercantilism. That's the gist of Hamilton's letter, which is online, by the way. You can go online and find Hamilton's letter to Robert Morris and read it for yourself. And so in the letter, he advocated protectionist tariffs, central bank, taxes on land, poll taxes, and a large public debt. And so Morris then contacted George Washington and had George Washington appoint him Treasury Secretary. And one of the very first things Hamilton went to work on is lobbying for a resurrection of the central bank, because the central bank was always the key to adopting mercantilism in America. It was always to be the funding vehicle for that. Rothbard called it the keystone of the enterprise. And so the purpose of it, according to its founders, was essentially to finance an empire modeled after the British Empire. So here we have the colonists supposedly fighting a revolution, a long, bloody revolution, against mercantilism, which the rallying cry was taxation without representation. But if you read the American Declaration of Independence, which has part of it is called the Train of Abuses, Thomas Jefferson complained not only about taxes, but about the interferences with free trade and how the King of England had interfered with our trade of the world and so forth. So it was the Declaration was in part a protest against British mercantilism being imposed on the United States. For what purpose? Well, to tax the colonists to pay for British imperialism, the Britain's wars with France and other sorts of things. And so the American nationalists wanted to bring that here. Okay, so they did. They did succeed in getting the first bank of the United States put into place as a successor of the Bank of North America. And the first Bank of the United States was a product of the big debate between Jefferson and Hamilton. Jefferson took the anti-bank side. Hamilton was the pro-bank side. But even the creation of this bank was based on corruption and not the strength of the arguments that were made over constitutionality by Jefferson and Hamilton. Jefferson made a very powerful argument that the Constitutional Convention had in fact considered a national bank and had rejected it. And so that would seem to be proof positive that a national bank was not constitutional. It's not mentioned under the enumerated powers of the U.S. Constitution. And at the time, they knew that they had actually discussed it at the Constitutional Convention and rejected the idea. And so Hamilton came back and basically invented the idea of implied powers of the Constitution. He said, yes, it's true, it's not in the Constitution, but if you read between the lines, there are implied powers. Not real powers, implied powers. And so once you accept that kind of argument, then there can be no limit to government power because politicians will think up anything. But in the end, how we got this bank, the first bank of the United States, was that George Washington cut a corrupt political deal with the Federalist Party. They were in the process of moving the nation's capital from New York to Virginia to create Washington, D.C. George Washington owned a huge tract of land, Mount Vernon, in Virginia. And the deal that he presented was extend the border of Washington, D.C. so that it is adjacent to my property, and I will sign the legislation creating the Bank of the United States. His argument had nothing to do with the constitutionality or the economic wisdom of having a bank run by politicians on the nation's capital. It had everything to do with enhancing George Washington's property values. And so the deal was done. The Federalists did redraw the map of Washington, D.C. George Washington's real estate values skyrocketed, and we got the Bank of the United States, which Murray Rothbard pointed out, created 72% inflation in the first 5 years of its existence, 72% price inflation. And so it also created a good bit of corruption. Here's the first president of the Bank of the United States was a United States Navy captain named William Jones, who knew absolutely nothing about banking and finance. And that was, he was the perfect puppet because he knew nothing. And so where could he make such a big salary anywhere else other than being the puppet of a man like Robert Morris and other sort of the banksters from New York, Philadelphia, and New England. And he left. And the second president was a man named Nicholas Biddle. And there's a book called Andrew Jackson and the Bank Wars that tells a lot about Nicholas Biddle. It really is a good classic expose on the Bank of the United States, but specifically on, if you fast forward American history to the second Bank of the United States, which came about after 1917, or in 1917. That's what mostly what the book is about, how Andrew Jackson eventually killed it. And Robert Remini is the author, and he actually cites Murray Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression. And so it's a very famous mainstream biographer citing Murray Rothbard. But here are some of the things that Remini says, what Biddle did as the president of this sort of precursor of the Fed. He granted below market interest rate loans and, quote, consulting contracts to members of Congress who promised to support the bank. These loans and, quote, consulting fees were essentially political kickbacks paid with taxpayers' dollars deposited in the Bank of the United States. Andrew Jackson's Treasury Secretary, Roger B. Taney, who was become eventually a Chief Justice of the United States, complained of what he called the bank's corrupting influence and its patronage greater than that of the government itself. And there's a book by a man named Maurice Baxter, who wrote a book called Henry Clay and the American System, which, and Henry Clay, the American politician Henry Clay, who was the Secretary of War, a member of Congress for many years, Speaker of the House of Representatives, died in 1852. He picked up the Hamiltonian nationalist mantle during his era. But he left Congress for 3 years beginning in the year 1822 after having incurred some $40,000 in personal debt. He was a big gambler. And so this is the early 1820s. He had $40,000 in debt. And so he quit Congress to become a, quote, consultant for the Bank of the United States. And here's what the historian Maurice Baxter says. It says, having incurred some $40,000 in personal debt to become the general counsel of the Bank of the United States, his income from the bank apparently amounted to what he needed to pay off his personal debts. When he resigned to become Secretary of State in 1825, he was pleased with his compensation. Who wouldn't be? He was paid a salary from the bank that was bigger than the salary of any governor in America. He was paid consulting fees on top of that, and he was also given huge, gigantic tracts of land for individual court cases that he litigated on behalf of the Bank of the United States. And so he made a killing, and that really guaranteed that he would be the spokesman for the Bank of the United States in Congress. Another prominent Whig, Henry Clay, was the leader of the Whig Party. Daniel Webster, he did not even bother to resign from Congress. He just collected bribes and kickbacks from the Bank of the United States for his support. He was a United States Senator. He demanded what he called a retainer. This is from Remini's book, a, quote, retainer. He wrote in a letter to Nicholas Biddle, the president of the Bank of the United States, if it wished that my relation to the bank should be continued, you will refresh my retainer. And so this is the type of corruption that went on by some of the leading lights of the U.S. Congress, such as Daniel Webster and Henry Clay at the time. And so just as the enemies or the opponents, the Jeffersonians of this scheme warned, this would corrupt politics. And it did really corrupt politics so much so that by the time you get to Andrew Jackson's era as president, it was well documented that the Bank of the United States, here's one of the things Remini writes, spent more than $100,000 in 1828 of the bank's deposits in support of Andrew Jackson's political opponents. It promised Bank of the United States money to friendly politicians to spend on pork barrel projects in their districts in return for their votes, and it paid for the printing of all Henry Clay's public speeches advocating an expansion of the Bank of the United States. And so it did corrupt politics. It used tax revenue deposits, to subsidize the political campaigns of the Federalists or the Nationalists in politics, but not the other side. Not that it would be good if they funded both sides. And so getting back to the original story, I'm sort of skipping back and forth through history here, getting back to the original story of the first bank, how we got it, this struggle between Hamilton and Jefferson, and Hamilton was essentially the political water carrier of the banksters, who were mostly New York, Philadelphia, and New England merchants, businessmen, and banksters. And as Treasury Secretary, Hamilton nationalized the public debt. Now, the debt to finance the American Revolution had been incurred by the state governments. And some states, like Virginia, had almost totally paid off their debt, but other states, like Massachusetts, had hardly paid on any of it. And so when Hamilton nationalized it, he essentially forced all American taxpayers to pony up to pay for all this debt that had been essentially defaulted on by states like Massachusetts. And so he did nationalize the debt. And so one of the things they did was to buy up all the war bonds that were outstanding at par value. And this created a giant or colossal arbitrage opportunity for the political insiders, including many of the people that I'm referring to as the banksters, because this was long before the internet, keep in mind. And so the insiders, including members of Congress and their friends in big business in New York, Philadelphia, New England primarily, they understood that the government was about to go and buy up, to pay off and buy off these bonds at 100% of value. But at the time, the bonds were trading on the market between 2 and 10% of par value. So there was a massive exodus up and down the eastern seaboard by the insiders to purchase all these bonds from old retired Revolutionary War veterans at 2%, 5%, 10% of their value, because they knew, but the sellers of the bonds did not know, that within a couple of months they would be able to get these bonds and turn them around and sell them for 10 to 20 times what they paid for them. And so here's how, there's a historian named Claude Bowers who wrote a famous book called Hamilton and Jefferson. And here's how he describes the scene. He says, he's talking about stagecoaches, he calls expresses. Expresses with very large sums of money on their way to the North Carolina, were on their way to North Carolina for the purposes of speculation in certificates, the bonds, splashed and bumped over wretched winter roads. Two fast-sailing vessels chartered by a member of Congress who had been an officer in the war were plowing the waters southward on a similar mission. So there was a mad scramble. New York newspapers speculated that Hamilton's political patron, Robert Morris, made at least $18 million on the deal. Hamilton himself purchased some of the bonds through buying agents, and many members of Congress made millions of dollars in the early 1800s through this arbitrage scheme. And so old Thomas Jefferson smoked this all out. He had this all figured out by sitting back and observing what was going on. He said in many years later, 1818, Hamilton died in 1804. In 1818, Hamilton's financial system had two objects. First, as a puzzle to exclude popular understanding and inquiry, and secondly, as a machine for the corruption of the legislature. So what he is saying is that this type of thing, this arbitrage that happened with the nationalization of the debt, is a way of bribing members of Congress, making them rich, turning them into millionaires, and after which they will always, forever vote for whatever the nationalists wanted, whether it was a bank, protectionist tariffs, or whatever, because those are the people who made them rich. And so, but there's a problem. There's a problem with this. Jefferson pointed out that this is a one-time deal. The debt arbitrage scheme was a one-time deal, and that those members of Congress who were bought off by the scheme will retire, they'll die, and with them will go their votes for the American system, to prop up the American system. So something more permanent is needed. Jefferson wrote in a letter, he says, men thus enriched by the dexterity of a leader like Hamilton would follow, of course, the chief who was leading them to fortune and thus become the zealous instruments of all of his enterprises, his political enterprises. But the political power, Jefferson wrote, created by these schemes would be temporary. It would be lost with the loss of the individual members whom it had enriched. Some engine of influence more permanent must be contrived, something more permanent that can last generation after generation to use to fund pork barrel politics and the bribing of politicians. And this engine was the Bank of the United States, Thomas Jefferson wrote. And so Jefferson suspected all along that the whole purpose of the bank, the main purpose of the bank, was not only to inflate credit, to inflate the monetary system, but to corrupt politics. It wasn't just an unfortunate side effect that some runaway bank, out-of-control bank, captured by evil people, became corrupt. It was designed to be that way. It was the modus operandi of the bank. In another letter, another essay, Thomas Jefferson described a dinner he had with Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of War Henry Knox, John Adams, President John Adams, and the U.S. Attorney General Edmund Randolph. And Jefferson says about this story he tells, "For the truth of which I attest the God who made me," and I think he swore on his children's graves also that this is true, "and at the dinner they were discussing the ideal form of government, and Hamilton objected to the fact that John Adams said that the British Constitution was the most ideal form of constitution ever devised by man, except for the corruption in British politics. Hamilton interjected and said, no, 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 that's the best part of it. If it were not for the corruption in British politics, it would not be the great government that it is. And so Hamilton revealed to everyone there that he thought political corruption was an essential part of any type of ideal government. And so that's why Jefferson once said that Hamilton was in favor not only of monarchy, which he was, but monarchy bottomed on corruption. And the central bank was always to be the essential part of that, that whole system. So banksterism was to be the American system. It was really banksterism that was set up as the American system. And so to give you some additional ideas of how thoroughly corrupt this always was, I think it's worth reading another passage from Rothbard's History of Money and Banking in the United States, where he talked about how it was that the second bank in the United States came into being. You know, the first bank in the United States was given a 20-year charter, and it was not renewed by Congress because it created so much corruption and so much economic instability, 72% price inflation, and so forth. Then the War of 1812 came, and the case was made that this bank was needed again to monetize the debt, the war debt, which it did, and the price level about doubled during that time, also. But here's how some of the banksters were involved in resurrecting the Bank of the United States, and why they were involved in it, and what they did. This is Rothbard saying, the Second Bank of the United States was pushed through Congress by the Madison administration, and particularly by Secretary of Treasury Alexander J. Dallas, whose appointment was lobbied for that purpose. Dallas, a wealthy Philadelphia lawyer, was a close friend, counsel, and financial associate of Philadelphia merchant and banker Stephen Girard, reputedly one of the two wealthiest men in the country. Toward the end of its term, Girard was the largest stockholder of the First Bank of the United States. So by the time you get to 1811, the year 1811, he was the largest stockholder in the bank. Girard became a very heavy investor in the war debt, in the War of 1812, of the federal government, both as a prospective large stockholder and as a way to unload his public debt, his war debt. Girard began to agitate for a new bank of the United States. Dallas's appointment as Secretary of the Treasury in 1814 was successfully engineered by Dallas and his close friend, wealthy New York merchant and fur trader John Jacob Astor, also a heavy investor in the war debt. When the Second Bank of the United States was established, Stephen Girard purchased the $3 million of the $28 million that had remained unsubscribed, and he and Dallas managed to secure for the post of president of the new bank their good friend William Jones, former Philadelphia merchant. Okay, so this was the way of unloading their war debt, was these two very wealthy banksters got involved in this and unloaded the war debt. Now my screen just went blank. I'm not sure if you can still see me. I guess I need some help from Danny. All of a sudden, my screen went blank. I hear footsteps. I'm like,
you can still see.
I don't know what happened. I didn't touch anything.
It's just a screen
saver. Sorry about that. The screensaver just kind of blanked me out, and so I wasn't sure if you can still see me. And so the Second Bank of the United States was created. It came back into existence in 1817. It allowed these people to unload their war debt. And also, it created the first big Great Depression in America. In fact, Murray Rothbard wrote his doctoral dissertation at Columbia University about it. It's called The Panic of 1819. And it is a book that the Mises Institute has, and it's online also, The Panic of 1819. And it created the first massive unemployment in American cities for the first time. And so the boom and bust cycle was alive and well. Okay, but then, so we had more of the same. The second bank of the United States corrupted politics, and so it ignited a crusade against banksterism. And this is, it's very, to someone like me, it's very enlightening to read about not just Andrew Jackson's crusade, but he had a lot of help from people all over the country, especially politicians in states like Ohio. The Bank of the United States had opened up two branches in the state of Ohio, and the state of Ohio did not want the Bank of the United States in there corrupting their politics and creating boom and bust cycles within their state. So they imposed a tax of $50,000 a year on each of the branch of the Bank of the United States, and the bank refused to pay. So the state of Ohio sent armed marshals into the vaults of the bank to take the money, and they did. The two armed marshals went in with a big chest to put the money in, and they took $100,000 from them. Other states did some similar things, like the state of Maryland did that to try to get rid of this menace, this bank run by politicians, but owned mostly by private individuals. And so this sort of culminated in a Supreme Court case called McCulloch versus Maryland. And this is a famous Supreme Court case where the Chief Justice of the United States, Marshall, who was a protege of Alexander Hamilton's in the old days, and who was a thoroughgoing nationalist and an aficionado of the American system. He was a nationalist through and through. He ruled that the Bank of the United States was constitutional. So they finally got a Supreme Court ruling on this many, many years after the old debate between Hamilton and Jefferson that took place in 1791. But Andrew Jackson responded by saying this, to this conclusion, he's referring to the conclusion that the Bank of the United States is constitutional, I cannot assent. Congress and the President, as well as the Court, must each for itself be guided by its own opinion of the Constitution. The opinion of the judges has no more authority over Congress than the opinion of Congress has over the judges. And on that point, the President is independent of both. The authority of the Supreme Court must not, therefore, be permitted to control the Congress or the executive when acting in their legislative capacities. End quote. So Jackson had the odd idea, being sarcastic, odd idea that there were three branches of government in the United States, not just one, and that he understood that the Constitution did not say who is to be the final judge on constitutionality. And so this was before the Lincoln administration. After the Lincoln administration, the federal government itself became the sole arbiter of constitutionality through its own courts. Before that, it was widely assumed that the president had an equal say, Congress has an equal say, and the people of the states, respectively, have an equal say on what is and is not constitutional. And so Jackson proceeded to defund the Second Bank of the United States and just allow it to run out of money. So you had two rounds of central banking long, long before the Fed. And you had two good examples of banksterism in action, political corruption, outright political corruption, not even hidden from public view, boom and bust cycles, price inflation. But that, of course, benefited everybody. Political corruption happens because somebody benefits from it. Price inflation happens because somebody benefits from expansion of the money supply. Look up on the line Cantillon effects if you want to do a little economic education in addition to what we're doing here, sort of a supplement. Cantillon, Cantillon, named after the French economist Richard Cantillon. It explains how when the money supply increases by the central bank, there's one group of people who get to use the money first before it has the effect of creating price inflation. And in our world today, this usually is the New York Wall Street bankster crowd who gets their paws on the money first because they're the ones who sell the government bonds and they're involved in that business. And so they get to make use of that money long before prices are inflated. By the time it gets through several multiplier effects down to the average citizen, having an effect on the average citizen, prices have been driven up, maybe even a recession has been created by the whole thing. and so the average person doesn't benefit from inflation, monetary inflation, but somebody does. Somebody always does, and that's why it exists. That's why it's used, as I said last week, to disguise the full cost of government. It's called fiscal illusion. And so we had a hiatus from this. Jackson was successful, and Murray Rothbard always thought of the Jacksonians as hardcore libertarians for the most part. Murray Rothbard was not naive. He did not think Andrew Jackson was a perfect libertarian idealist. He did some bad things. He was a politician after all. But by and large, the people in American politics who thought of themselves as Jacksonians and saw Andrew Jackson as their standard bearer politically were largely libertarian. And so whenever I say something like this or write something like this online, I always get emails from people pointing out this or that bad thing that Andrew Jackson did, that he was a murderer of the Seminole Indians. That was an awful thing he did early in his life. But we're talking about banking here. And so with regard to banking, he did a good thing. I don't need to make the argument that everything he did throughout his entire life was a good thing. Who can you say that about? But this was a good thing. Defunding the bank, the second bank in the United States. So we had a hiatus from large-scale political control of the money supply for a while, for about 20-some years. This is sometimes called the free banking era, where there were state-issued currencies. Well, one of the currencies was known as the Dix, D-I-X. This is where the word Dixie comes from, referring to the southern states in America, as in the song Dixie. And it was the New Orleans Bank that issued this currency. And Dix comes from the French word 10. You know, they spoke a version of French and still do to this day in New Orleans and that part of Louisiana in the United States. And it was such a popular currency, such a strong currency backed by gold and silver, that it was even used in Minnesota, you know, a thousand miles north of New Orleans. And so we had an alternative monetary system that was much more competitive. We had competing currencies. There was no national bank. There was government regulation during this time. There was the occasional suspension of specie payment. And you had politicians like Abraham Lincoln, who was for many years, for decades, a foremost proponent of suspension of specie payment, as were all the big Whig politicians in the party. And so at this point, I might as well read you my favorite Rothbard quote about the meaning of suspension of specie payment. That is, telling banks, government telling banks, they do not have to redeem currency and gold. Now here's what Rothbard said in What Has Government Done to Our Money? The bluntest way for government to foster inflation is to give banks the special privilege of refusing to pay their obligations while continuing in their operation. While everyone else must pay their debts or go bankrupt, the banks are permitted to refuse redemption of their receipts at the same time forcing their own debtors to pay when their loans fall due. The usual name for this is, quote, a suspension of specie payments, end quote. A more accurate name would be, quote, license for theft, end quote. For what else can we call a government permission to continue business without fulfilling one's contract? And so the Whig Party picked up the mantle of that and fought mightily for the resurrection of a nationalized banking system. And we did get that in the 1860s with the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts that created the greenback dollar, and which also went a long way toward monopolizing the money supply by the federal government by imposing a special 10% tax on competing currencies. And the Republican Party was in existence at the time, and the leading lights of the Republican Party were ecstatic over the resurrection of a nationalized banking system. Here's one quote I'll read to you that Senator John Sherman at the time, this is in the 1860s, was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. He was the brother of General William Tecumseh Sherman, the famous American Civil War general. And he was one of the most powerful Republicans in Congress as chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. This is the same Senator Sherman who almost 30 years later would have his name attached to the Sherman Antitrust Law. But he said this about the National Currency Acts. He said the objective of the Republican Party was, quote, to nationalize as much as possible, even the currency, so as to make men love their country before their states. All private interests, all local interests, all banking interests, the interests of individuals, everything should be subordinate now to the interests of government, end quote. That was Senator John Sherman celebrating the passage of the National Currency Acts. And of course, as chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, he was one of the most corrupt individuals in the whole history of American politics. He was one of the big mover shakers who was funneling subsidies, hidden and not so hidden, to the banksters of the era. And of course, at the same time, another reason they were so ecstatic, the Republican big shots were so ecstatic, because they were commencing the biggest exercise in corporate welfare in the history of the world up to that point, which was the massive subsidies to the building of transcontinental railroads, and they wanted a nationalized currency to facilitate that sort of empire building, and they did. One of the sponsors of the banking legislation in the House of Representatives was a congressman from New York, a banker from Buffalo, New York, named Eldridge Spaulding. And he also was just ecstatic. He was just celebrating this because he thought it would pave the way for unlimited patronage spending by his party. The New York Times was sort of the newspaper mouthpiece of the Republican Party, and they said this: in 1863, the Legal Tender Act and the National Currency Bill crystallized a centralization of power such as Hamilton might have eulogized as magnificent. Okay. One of the dissenters at the time was a Kentucky member of Congress from Kentucky, a Democrat named Lazarus Powell. He wrote this about the National Currency Acts: the result of this legislation is to utterly destroy the rights of the states. It is asserting a power which, if carried out to its logical result, would enable the National Congress to destroy every institution of the states and cause all power to be concentrated here in Washington, D.C. Well, exactly. That was always the idea, because the people of the states might object to massive corporate welfare subsidies to railroad corporations. They might object to high protectionist tariffs in some of the states for manufacturers almost exclusively located in the northern states, who would then sell them clothing and farm tools and other things at grossly inflated prices thanks to protectionist tariffs. So yeah, a lot of the people in the states would object to that. But now, with this centralization of money, the Republicans knew exactly what they're doing. They were ecstatic over it. They knew that they could snuff out local opposition to the Hamiltonian dream of finally bringing British-style mercantilism to America. And so they did. And so they did with the National Currency Acts and the Legal Tender Acts. The Secret Service was created during this time also to police competing counterfeiters. The greenback dollars was legalized counterfeiting, but if there were competing currencies that did not abide by all their taxes and regulations, the Secret Service was set up not to protect the president from would-be assassins, but to police competition in currency. And that was the origins of the American so-called Secret Service. And so this is about what I wanted to have to say for tonight with regard to banksterism from the time of Alexander Hamilton and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson up through that part of history or of the Lincoln administration. And the period of American history after that I call Hamiltonian hegemony, because the banksters pretty much ran the show, which is to say the Republican Party ran the show. And next week we're going to move on. We're going to look in much more detail in Rothbard's power elite analysis of the House of Rockefeller and the House of Morgan, and how subsequent generations of politicians have done more of the same old racket that the British Empire was involved in before the American Revolution. But it's just the a more modern day version of the same thing, the same kind of thing, banksterism. And so I have about 6:15 Eastern time. I'm in Central Time here in Auburn, Alabama. And but we'll do what we usually do. I'll scope the Q&A, and I'll be glad to do my best to answer any questions that that you might have. Let's see, Zachary's asked me if I read Federighi's book, The Political Philosophy of Alexander Hamilton. Yeah, I have read over it. I didn't cite it in my book, but I have looked at it. There are quite a few books like that. One of the best books, the most useful to me, was William Graham Sumner wrote a biography, a political biography of Alexander Hamilton. And there's also a book that I cited very widely in my book, Hamilton's Curse. Is called Alexander Hamilton and the Constitution by Clinton Rossiter. And it's a fine piece of research, a really great piece of research by sort of the last generation historian, Clinton Rossiter. And Rossiter was a big fan of Hamilton. So even though I disagreed with a lot of what's in the book, he did his homework. It was a very well-written book on Hamilton's political philosophy. And also, I would recommend, if anybody's interested, look up, there's an article on Hamilton called The Rousseau of the Right, that I think is probably the best article ever written about Hamilton's political philosophy, such as it was. And so, The Rousseau of the Right. And I'll have to look up the reference. I can't think of the author's name off the top of my head right now. It's been a long, long time since I read it. Let's see, Lucas is asking if I really believe there are participants in the banking system and really believe in what they're doing, that they're the benefit of Americans. Oh, sure, it's easy. I think it's very easy for people to convince themselves that they're promoting the public interest. It's easy for people to delude themselves. Since I've written sort of several iconoclastic books on American history and American politics and hundreds of articles, I have always gotten lots and lots of mail by people who become very, very upset when you present them with plain, undisputed historical facts that dispute some sort of vision that they have in their head about what should be out there. So it's very easy for a lot of people to delude themselves, and a lot of people prefer to live in a sort of a fairyland existence, especially when it's about what you're doing for a living. The ordinary banker who goes through the bank's training program and learns how to make housing loans is not the person I'm talking about here. It's the movers and shakers who are the lobbyists for the entire banking industry and the major stockholders of the big investment banks. It's not the employee you talk to when you go to your bank to make a deposit every day. Those are not the people we're talking about here. Those people don't have much of an idea of where they fit in the entire system of political economy in the world. Let's see if I can find any more questions here. Let's see, I'm going to look for another question. See, Jim has a question. The most recent example of a country using a specie standard, 100% reserve. I don't think there are any recent examples that I know of anybody going into a 100% gold reserve system. Maybe somebody out there can enlighten me on that, but I don't think there is an example. Doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It just means government is too powerful so far to allow such a thing to happen. Let's see.
You are not the right fellow.
No. Gary North just stepped in and told me I'm not the right fellow. I guess he's in the wrong room. I'm doing an online class on banksterism.
Keep that.
Okay, so Phil asked me, have you read Julian Boyd's number 7, in which the Princeton historian claimed Alexander Hamilton was a double agent? No, I haven't read that book for the British. I haven't read that book. I don't know how Julian Boyd would ever be able to know that. Secret agents tend to be secret. But I think you don't need to make up a conspiracy theory to criticize Alexander Hamilton. It's wide out in the open. He was an agent for New York, New England, Philadelphia banksters and other merchants. And if they did business or had connections with British businessmen, well, so what? A lot of people did. And so I don't think you have to write a spy novel to criticize Hamilton. Read my book, Hamilton's Curse, and you'll get plenty of material to criticize Hamilton's views with. Let's see. Michael Colbert says we have a transfer of wealth from the working class to the political class. Yes, the political class and a lot of their supporters, not just the politicians themselves. Inflation and price inflation tends to make exports look cheaper to foreigners. Because of inflation, the inflated price, it's sort of the general effect of inflation. It's sort of similar to the effect that if you borrow money and then you have inflation, you're paying back the banker. Say you made a loan at 5% interest, you're paying them back at an inflated dollar. So it's advantageous to you to take on debt in a period of price inflation as long as the interest rate is not sufficiently high. That's why whenever expected inflation goes up, banks raise interest rates because they're trying to cover themselves for the risk of price inflation going up and being paid back in inflated dollars. The sort of a similar type of thing happens when you talk about international trade, and it makes American exports look better, look cheaper to foreigners. There's a question. Did any of the early American advocates of mercantilism have personal experience working at the Bank of England? Hamilton himself, as a teenager, worked for a British businessman in the Caribbean, the island of St. Croix, who were molasses exporters and who must have had very close contacts with the Bank of England. And they were slave owners. They ran a slave plantation. The slaves ground sugar cane by pushing mules around and did all the work, and they exported the molasses to Europe and elsewhere, and the sugar all around the world. And so that was Hamilton's upbringing. He was a clerk for them, and these same men are the men who sent Hamilton. They thought he was a brilliant young man. They sent him to what is now Columbia University to get educated. They paid for his education at the time. So Hamilton himself had some familiarity with how people can become rich by working the British mercantile system, because the men who were his benefactors were very, very wealthy. They lived a high life, and Hamilton must have been very, very impressed at what a good life they were living. And that was his economic education on how to become a wealthy person through mercantilism, through political connections, through banksterism, and the rest. And so when he got older and became prominent in politics, he naturally thought that he and his friends should get rich in the same way. Let's see, here's a question from Graham. In some of the readings, it was evident that the manipulation of specie or gold and silver was important to hence profit of paper money. Do you see evidence today that the Federal Reserve is manipulating the price of gold and silver? Well, you know, Ron Paul's effort to audit the Fed failed. We don't know a lot about what the Fed is doing apart from the minutes it publishes of its open market committee meetings and a few other things. I don't have evidence myself. I don't know of any that the Fed is trying to manipulate the price of gold and silver, but of course the Fed has done much worse things. And so it's not manipulated by expanding the money supply and creating inflationary expectations. It is inducing a lot of people to buy gold and silver, that's for sure. I don't know if you can call that manipulating the price of gold and silver or not, but I suspect that Graham's question has to do with more directly manipulating, like the Fed buying it itself. I don't think it's doing that, but the Fed's inflationary monetary policy has sparked inflationary expectations, which always leads to an increased demand for gold purchases. Yes, it's true. Rami says inflation makes imports look more expensive and therefore protects domestic producers in domestic markets too. It's de facto protectionism. Let's see, Leslie has a question. Hamilton's ostensible rationale for central bank was that inflationary policies were needed. I'm not familiar that Hamilton ever made that argument. I've read through Hamilton's famous reports on the constitutionality of a central bank, which is online, and he doesn't make any argument like that. So when he was arguing with Jefferson over this, he didn't say this. Maybe you think he should have said that because there was a shortage of money in the economy, but in fact there wasn't a shortage of money in the economy. If we're on the gold standard, there doesn't need to be a flood of currency. There is such a thing as the velocity of money. Money turns over when we use it. And it's a good thing that there's, quote, a shortage of money, because the opposite of that is an excess supply of money, which creates inflation. So it's a good thing that, that governments are constrained and banks are constrained from inflating and destroying the currency. And so I would argue with the idea that there was a shortage of money. And I'm not familiar with the idea that Hamilton ever actually made that argument. Others have, but I don't think Hamilton did. Trudeau was a strong spokesman for sound money, and so he was an advocate of the gold standard. So he certainly would have opposed this idea that we need more money in circulation created by a bank run by politicians. I think I mentioned in the last class that if you were to walk into Thomas Jefferson's house, Monticello, outside of Charlottesville, Virginia today, there's a statue of Turgot right by the front door. He was Thomas Jefferson translated the economic writings of Turgot into English. Let's see, there's a what I split. I've heard that the gold price is affected by the use of naked shorts in the gold paper. Well, that's not a question. Question by Travis, would you support the gold standard of Rothbard or no standard with competing currencies of Hayek from his denationalization of money? I would support either. I think either thing that we could get. If we could get competing currencies of the sort Hayek describes, I would support that and as possibly a stepping stone to a Rothbardian gold standard. So I don't think, if you're thinking of what you would think the world to look like in terms of monetary policy, I don't think you have to be a hardcore advocate of any one thing. I think competing currencies would help wean a lot of people away from the idea that we have to have this sort of Wizard of Oz named chairman of the Fed in charge of the whole money supply of the country and a monetary monopoly. So I would favor either of them. Phil Boggs asked the question, why or how did the hard money Jefferson Jacksonians fade out of existence? Well, that's a good question. I think the answer I would give is that they never did completely fade out of existence. There were always some advocates of this. But when we're going to talk in the next week or two about the creation of the Fed, and when the creation of the Fed, many of the leading lights of academia in America became supporters of the Fed because they were a part of the whole bankster cabal. They were very well paid to be spokesmen for the nationalization of money. The so-called progressives were, this was a part of their agenda. They wanted to create heaven on earth in America, and then they wanted to move to Europe and create heaven on earth there, which they tried to do when Woodrow Wilson was president, I suppose. But when you get to the early 20th century, you have the system whereby the Fed was created and the federal government got the income tax. And you had already had, for a couple of generations, sort of creeping socialism in academia, more and more government involvement and control of higher education especially. And so the people who were the academics and the economists and the writers were already being affected by creeping statism and the biases that it creates, such as not being too critical of the free market, or of statism and of being a free market advocate. And so these were the dark days of libertarianism, of free market economics, the early 20th century, up to really the 1970s and 80s, where the main reason I've always thought was the overwhelming government control of higher education that was even prevalent back in those days, back in the early 20th century in the United States. And of course, there's many, many orders of magnitude worse today. But they tended to have the money, government money, that could be used to drown out the voices of the free bankers and the Jacksonians and the hard money people that were out there. They never died off. And of course, the Austrians were always the ones who never gave up the fight and were always keeping the candle lit under the understanding about sound money, and we're making a big comeback today. Let's see, here's Vitt says, I consider Edmund Griffin to be crazy. I heard you think he's in his book. Well, I read his book years ago, and it's where there's some things in there that are accurate. You know, some of these things he writes about did happen. But I did think that his economics was kind of weird, and so I never cite it as a serious book. I know a lot of people are big fans of it, and so I just thought he sort of flew off the handle on the economic aspects in a couple of places that I was reading. So I'm not a psychiatrist, so I wouldn't call him crazy, but sort of misguided on economics. Although there was a lot in there. Anybody can document plain historical facts. I read a lot of books by socialists and neo-socialists and Marxists and whatnot, and these people are good compilers of facts, but of course facts are only useful if you have a logical and realistic interpretation of them, and that's where Austrian economics comes in. It helps you take the same facts that these people use but see them in a different way, have a different understanding of the meaning of these facts. Which circle of hell is reserved for big banksters? I'm not sure. I can't answer that one. I agree with you, though, that they should be in a circle of hell. I never really studied Ben Franklin. Bob Shaw wants to know Ben Franklin's stand on National Bank. I'll have to look that up. Certainly, the person to ask would be Mark Skousen. He's actually a descendant of Benjamin Franklin. So if you look up in one of Skousen's more recent books, I bet you would find him. And I'll do that and report back to you next week. Let's see, if I can find some more. Let's see, Rob is asking, my personal experiences make seem people are more aware of banksterism today outside of the Mises Academy camps. Oh, yes, the Campaign for Liberty in America, the Ron Paul group. I've spoken to over the past couple of years some of the events with the rooms of more than 1,000 people, including hundreds and hundreds of mostly young people I think it was the University of Michigan or Michigan State maybe, where Ron Paul gave a speech and when he was running for president in the year 2008, and there were something like 2,500 students there who began spontaneously chanting, "End the Fed, end the Fed." And so it wasn't anybody associated with the Mises Institute who coined that phrase. It was students, undergraduate students at one of the big Michigan universities that did that. Of course, Ron Paul ended up titling one of his books, End the Fed. But that's where he got the title. It was a spontaneous chant in a major American university. And so, and there are many, many thousands of these mostly young people who are educating themselves. It's not just people taking courses through the Mises Academy. I have literally given speeches in front of over 1,000 people alongside Lou Rockwell and people like that and Tom Woods, and have the crowd just be very enthusiastic about it and sell a lot of books. And so don't think that you're alone out there sitting in front of your computer taking these courses, but you're a lone wolf. It's people like me who were the lone wolves 25 years ago doing these things. And not to mention Ludwig von Mises and Rothbard, they were the real lone wolves out there. They had almost nobody. They used to say in the 1970s that the whole libertarian movement in America could fit inside of Murray Rothbard's living room, which is probably true. I have no idea if Mark Skousen is related to David Skousen, so I can't answer that. Let's see, Phil has a question. Did Mises or Rothbard comment or have any theories on regression of history? Read Mises' book, Theory and History. Rothbard, of course, wrote many books about historical subjects, but they weren't, but they were believers in human action, though. That's the whole point of the power elite analysis of Rothbard, that there is no inevitable, inherently inevitable path of history. Human beings act, and human beings cause things to happen. And ideas have a very important influence on how many human beings act. So that's one of the reasons why people like Mises and Rothbard were so motivated to do what they did for so many years, all the research and writing and teaching and lecturing, is to try to change the culture of ideas so that the powers that be will perhaps be persuaded or forced to act by the public to act a little differently for the good. And there's the link to Theory and History by Cam. Let's see, Travis wants to know, where was that? He had a question. I lost his question. Would corporatism be considered mercantilism? Yeah, it's sort of a synonym. Corporatism is a synonym for some crony capitalism, to be sure. Comment on the banksters in Cyprus. Well, yes, the banksters in Cyprus lost. I guess they wanted a bailout, but the legislature voted against the bailout. So that's my comment on the banksters in Cyprus. Still looking for another question here. Let's see, John, is it dangerous to publish books on banks in the U.S.? No, it's not. Those of us who do would be in jail. Tom Woods would be in jail. I'd be in jail. Guido Holzman would be in Guantanamo because he comes to the U.S. quite often. And so, no, it's not dangerous. They sell. There's a market for books. People in the United States, a lot of people are highly, highly suspicious this weird-looking guy with a beard making pronouncements about the future of their money. That is Ben Bernanke every once in a while. And that they're catching on that something is rotten here. And so even the popular books, as opposed to the deeply scholarly books, are catching on in the United States. Good. Cam, run down the Rousseau of the right. Oh, yeah, Kenyon. Her name is Kenyon. Cecilia Kenyon is the author. Okay, I'm still looking for more questions here. I'm working on a popular book. I'm working on a book on the political economy of war right now. Let's see, I'm looking for more questions here. Any more questions? Have I read The Coming Battle? No, I haven't. That's from Phil again. Okay, somebody suggested an article by Higgs. Bob Higgs is great on this whole business of mercantilism. He calls it participatory fascism. He says that the American economic system is basically fascism now, but they do let us vote once in a while to validate fascism, so that's where the participatory part comes into play. Let's see, I'm looking for a few more questions that I might have missed. No, I don't think so. Let's see, a question from Lucas. Elaborate the difference between mercantilism and fascism. Well, they've sort of evolved together. I write about this a bit in my book, Hamilton's Curse, in the later chapters. That this idea of ostensible private fascism is private enterprise is permitted, unlike socialism, which originally meant government ownership of the means of production, but it is very highly regimented and controlled and used for purposes defined by the state. And so you can't just cater to consumers like in capitalism. You have to do things the state wants you to do. And so I guess if there's a difference, on the one hand, if I think of German or Italian fascism from an economic perspective, there was the militarism was a big part of it. And so these corporations were allowed to exist and the owners were allowed to make profits, but they had to fuel the state. They had to produce armaments for the army, and they had to produce things that the state wanted them to produce and pay minimal attention to what the people actually wanted as consumers, whereas mercantilism is simply more like a conspiracy between politics and business to rip off the customer for the benefit of politicians and businessmen. And it's not necessarily based on any sort of grandiose nationalistic design to make Italy the greatest nation on the earth or anything like that. It's just all about money and power. And so, but they adopted many of the same ideas, mercantilism and fascism. You could also call it economic nationalism, economic fascism, very similar. Modern-day conservative republicanism, that's certainly true. One of the articles of mine, I believe I put it on our syllabus for this course, is on economic fascism. So if you just look up, go on the web and type in economic fascism by me, you'll find about a 15 or 20-year-old article by me on economic fascism. Okay. Well, we're sort of running out of gas. I guess I got 6:15. Maybe we'll call it a night then, folks. It's about 6:15. And we're seeing to be running out of questions. Thanks again for participating. I hope you learned a few more things. Thanks for the great questions. I wish I had more time to answer them. It's a lot of great questions, and it really is enjoyable for me to have students like you who are into it and are asking me good questions like that. I wish I could do a better job of answering them. So have a good week, and next week we'll really get into the nitty-gritty of Rothbardian power and lead analysis.